Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Cultured Bumpkin. So I just got a new podcast streaming software thing called StreamYard, and I love it. This episode is my first one where I use it, but for the first, 45 minutes, I have the mic across the room, and I'm all echoey and everything. You can hear me fine, but it's all echoey, so please excuse that. I will get better, I promise. So, on to the episode.
You're listening to The Cultured Bumpkin, a literature podcast with Jake Phillips, where we present audiobook quality readings of the classics for your enjoyment. Thank you for stopping by. And remember, just because you're a bumpkin doesn't mean you can't be cultured.
Hello and welcome to The Cultured Bumpkin. This is the inaugural StreamYard Cultured Bumpkin stream with a guest. So today I have TJ Whitehead. TJ, thank you for agreeing to come on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I can't wait. This is our third time's the charm. Been trying to do this. This is our third time. It actually worked out for both of us.
Exactly. Well, thank you for making time for this. And so TJ and I, we have connected on TikTok. We've never met in person. That I know of, you know, we're
That's
both,
true, yeah.
We'll get into that. We very well might've like bumped into each other.
That'd somewhere. Be so weird, man. It's happened before where, you know, so, oh my God, I didn't know I met you. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Right. Like I was at that place. Oh yeah. You're the guy. I'm just kidding. We're on TikTok. That is your, TikTok handle, right? That you
correct.
Have.
Powers taken, not given. Yeah.
Good deal. Do you have YouTube or anything like that?
So, yeah, I have a YouTube account with the same name that has, I think, exactly two videos up. And I'm just now starting to, I've got a few interviews recorded. I'm going to start releasing them in little bits and pieces. Okay. So, yeah. And I'm also part of another podcast called the Left Wing Pod on okay. YouTube. So you can check those out as well.
Good deal. So I think what's interesting about TJ and I is, like, we're very different in our viewpoints of just stuff, like worldview even. And yet I think he's like, you know, the coolest dude on TikTok.
Oh, stop.
No,
stop.
I really
flattery will get you everywhere.
I like your opinions, your viewpoints on things, because I think you have a great way of like, there's a saying, laughter opens up the heart. And I think when you're telling jokes and being funny, you can a lot of times reach some places that you might not reach otherwise. And you're just a entertaining guy. And so I'm looking forward to this chat.
I am as well. And I wanted to say quick before I talk about you is that I agree 100%. Humor is incredibly disarming. And the example I like to use about this is, has anyone ever insulted you and got you with a burn that was just deep? And it was funny, and even you knew it. And you're laughing, but it's hard to be angry when you're laughing. And so if you can get your point across in a way that's insightful and clever and humorous, you may not win the person over, but they're going to be a lot more likely to listen to you. So that's a perfect observation. And as far as your content, I love your name. I love, well, not Jake Phillips, which is it's a fine name, but that's not what I was referring to. the Cultured Bumpkin, because I'm pretty sure I ran across your account when someone sent me your like a video you had or a handle or something and said that, hey, this guy is looking for people who's deep into literature, and I know you're into literature. You should check him out. And I loved what I saw. Like, it's such a good concept. I remember you saying something or reading something about you that you said that your old man would read to you guys as kids, and that's how you developed the love for literature. And anyone who loves literature is a friend of mine. I'll put it that way, because like it's hard to meet someone who's just you meet a lot of people who are I don't know if you're gonna be swear. I don't know. Should I just go ahead?
This is a lot of kids and grandmas.
Okay, all right, thank you. All right, thank you.
But also a free speech zone. So just whatever, however
I'll be feel. Respectful. I'll be respectful. Yeah, a lot of people who you know are pretty unpleasant that are like, you know, tech guys or STEM guys or even science people or history. Oh man, history people can be really annoying, but literature people, it's very hard to find someone who isn't interesting to talk to because, you know, studying literature and understanding it and grasping it and analyzing it takes a lot of human empathy and interaction into the human condition that I really enjoy. So, and especially, I love when you do it in your accent. That's great. that's just a fun bonus for me.
Right, right. That's awesome. Well, same right back at you. And, you know, I think I found something of yours and you were analyzing some poem. I think I don't remember what it was, but I was anyway very interested and I'm excited to talk to you about, you know, your background and stuff. So to start off, kind of what can you just tell us a little about yourself?
Yeah, I was born in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I'm an Army brat. My dad was in the military for 22 years. We started going to a Christian school when I was in fifth grade. And it was a super right-wing Christian fundamentalist school that I have a lot of problems with, especially today. But one thing it did have and did instill in me was an excellent literature, grammar, and spelling program. And I was not, I really sucked at grammar, which is funny thinking now that I was terrible at it, you know, for most of my life. But I always loved literature and I was always a good speller too. So it always worked out. And I loved reading stories. And we would have these sections in our spelling book that in the very back were poems. And so I don't know, once a month we had to memorize one poem. And we would, you know, we would repeat it like every day, 5-6 times. We repeat the stanzas 5 or 6 times. And then at the end of the month, you had to recite the poem. And I still remember most of those poems. And I learned a lot of classic literature, you know, from those days. And in college, you know, I read a whole bunch. And in grad school, I read a whole bunch. And I don't read anymore, ever. Like, I never read books anymore, which surprises people. Like, I haven't read in 7 years. And I don't plan on reading anymore. But I did have a voracious love for reading and storytelling and literature and the themes of the past and the future. Yeah, you can see in literature. And I can replace a lot of that with cinema now. There's a really excellent television program, HBO, called Rome. And have you seen it? Or you're familiar with it?
No, but I know what you're talking about.
It's so good, man. It's so good. And I really like it because whenever you watch a series about, you know, past important events, you know, the French Revolution, you know, Civil War, stuff like that. It's always told in our history books are the same way. And our literature, you know, by design, is that it's told through the eyes of the upper class. It's told through the eyes of the literate, of the rich and the powerful, the people in high positions. But what Rome did is that half of the show is through the eyes of, like, you know, Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra and all those folks. But the other half is through the eyes of two regular Roman soldiers named Lucius Verinus and Titus Pullo. Now, these two individuals, they interact with, you know, Caesar and all them too, but you get to see it at the upper level and at the common level, which you never see, really. Like, you don't see the show through those people's eyes. And Pullo and Verinus were two soldiers who Caesar mentioned in his journals. And he doesn't say too much about them, because they're the only two common soldiers he ever mentioned in his journal. And he said that, you know, there are these two soldiers I got here and named Verinus and Pullo, and they have a pretty good friendly rivalry, and I respect the work that they do. That's all we actually know about those two. But to take a show and build it around those two common people is fantastic. And literature does that pretty well, is that you get to see, oh yeah, but from the show, a lot of things I like watching were the personal interactions and the politics and how very similar it is today, and that we haven't changed all that much in 2000 years. And, you know, literature is, you know, the pre-cinema version of that. And so that's one reason I enjoy it.
Interesting. So what you said right there, that you've done a lot of reading, which is not surprising, but you don't plan on doing it anymore, which is surprising. Why is that?
Okay, so there's two reasons. A good one and a bad one. Now, the first reason is the good one. And the first reason is that I started figuring out that reading is a decent way to learn, but it's not the most efficient. They're like listening to something or watching something. You can do something else and it's done a lot quicker. My eyes don't get tired. I don't lose my place while I'm reading and everything. And you just tell me to sit down and read a 500-page book. That is not going to happen. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do it. I have the time. I'm just not going to. And plus, I've just read so much over the years that I have a pretty good basis on the stuff that I talk about. Now, I'll read articles. You know, I'll read journals and stuff like that. But like reading a book, basically start to finish, something I never plan on doing. The second reason is a bad one. And that is in high school, I started noticing, and I've noticed it my entire life since then, hasn't gone away, that people tend to use the number of books they've read as like an indicator of how smart they are. And that drives me insane because I knew people who's like, I read 35 books this year and they were the dumbest, least impressive individuals I've ever met in my life. This happens all the time. And so people would just brag about, oh, I read 4 books this month. I read 6 books these last 2 weeks or whatever. And I always hide my power level on this. I never talk about it. And I get to know these people and, you know, they can say what they want about me, but they can't say I'm dumb. They can't. And so they give it. And so then it's like, what would you like? Yeah, I haven't read a book in years. I don't read at all. And then, so it kind of just crashes that whole thing down. I like, it's like the one petty thing that I like to do is like, yeah, it turns out you don't need to read 10 books, you know, every 6 months to be a smart person. Now, once again, that's not a good reason. You know, reading books, if you read books, that doesn't mean you're dumb. If you don't read books, that doesn't mean you're dumb. And it doesn't mean I'm smart, but those are my two reasons.
Okay. Interesting. That's kind of like, you know, when, let's say in the army where you're, you know, doing marksmanship and there's somebody that's never shot before, didn't grow up on a farm, nothing like that. And then they're the best shot after 5 minutes of instruction.
Well,
it's kind of disappointing to some of the guys that are.
Well, about that, I remember in basic training, our drill sergeant saying that the people who weren't super familiar with firearms actually come in with an advantage because they haven't learned any bad habits. They're not going to be using Kentucky windage and they're not going to be like comparing it to the way they use it. I don't know if that's true or not, but is it something like that?
Well, you know, like it's not in your case that you haven't read. You have read. They're just, you know, a while back. What I mean is, you know, when you beat someone in an argument and then they find out immediately afterwards, you don't read.
Like, yeah. That's
very disheartening. It's like the it's like the redneck that's going to beat everybody, and then the city kid from New York.
Yeah,
she's better than him. I always thought that was funny.
It is. So, all right. I'll tell my military story first. I joined the military in 2011, and I was in 10 years. I got out. I medically retired. I had bad hip problems. And they started pretty early, actually. They started like in 2014. And I remember going to our PA, I forget what it's called, like the aid station at the unit. I was stationed in Fort Bragg at the time. And had really sharp pain in my hips. And I was telling, hey, this is a big problem. And so my PA said that, well, I think it's what's it called? Femoral acetabular impingement, which basically meant that my hips were, you know, closing in on the muscle around, or my bones were closing on the muscles, causing an impingement. And I said, okay, well, how can we know if that's what it is? And he says, well, we'll need to get an MRI to check. But if it is what I'm suspecting, you're not going to be able to deploy. We're about to deploy in like 2 months. And I was like, all right, I'm not getting the MRI. I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. And so fast forward like 7 years or something, and my hips are so bad that I have to have them replaced. And I got my hips replaced in 2021, which is bizarre. Like no one, every time I went to like the clinic, everyone there was like north of 65. I'm the only person there. But, and so I medically retired then. What about you?
I joined in, I guess, 03 in ROTC. So I had a ROTC scholarship at Mississippi State and then commissioned in 07. And then just did a little over 4 years active duty.
Got okay.
I didn't like officers, turns out.
See, that's funny. I liked them more. No. That's funny. Yeah, that's weird. What was your branch? I was air defense. What was your branch?
Okay, I was 19 series. So I was 19 Alpha Cav Scout.
Cav Scouts. Okay, all right. Yeah.
But I was in a, I was attached with a lot of infantry. And we went to Northern Iraq, up in Sinjar in 2009 and 10 was my one deployment.
So you got out after your term, your 4 years that you owed for ROTC or what?
Right. I think I was over a little over 4 years, but yeah, I just.
Smart.
I did it.
Smart. And, smart.
I was kind of, my thinking was, okay, I'm going to put down infantry and, armor and then artillery, that kind of thing. And if I go infantry, that's going to be my sign to like go all in, be a military career man. Mm-hmm. And if I get armor, I'm going to just feel it out or anything else.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay. And I got in and, man, I'm glad I did that because I just didn't like the army.
Yeah.
I'm glad I did it and stuff like that. But also, the leadership was terrible and I just had a bad time of it, I think.
Yeah. It's not for everyone. That's the best way I can describe the military. It's just not for everybody. And it takes a particular type of person to even get through the training and do the job. Because a lot of people don't, as you saw, a lot of people don't. And sticking with it, and everyone's military experience is different too. And like, there's a lot of like things we have in common that we'll all know, but a lot of it depends on, like you said, your leadership in your unit, because if you get stuck with the wrong battalion commander, it's over. Yes. I mean, like you're going to have a rough time and it's unfortunate, but that's the reality.
Right. So one interesting thing about the military for me, that's really where I fell in love with literature.
Oh,
because now, like I had mentioned, my dad had read to us and I sort of had a great appreciation for it, but I didn't really have a passion. It was like, mm-hmm. Oh, it's cool. I like it. Nothing against it sort of thing. When I was, I think I was at NTC, Fort Irwin. It's the Mojave Desert. For those that aren't familiar, it's just the most awful place on earth. I don't know. It makes some parts of Iraq seem downright now. Going from there over to Iraq. Anyway, Jane Austen in particular became a getaway for me because it's so different, right?
Yeah.
You know, the manners are different. The customs are different. The things that wind them up and, get them all in a tizzy are different. And it was a wonderful escape for me just because it's so different. It's sunny and, it's nice. And anyway, I just love Jane Austen for that reason. I read, I think, all but one of her books, Northanger Abbey. I think I read all the other ones within a very short period of time. But I also really got into the Lord of the Rings and, poetry and stuff like that. It just became an escape for me. So that's one thing that I really liked about the Army is it sort of, I don't know, it sort of guided me. That and voice acting. So that it got me into voice acting. My platoon sergeant told me, you have to learn to speak English because nobody can understand. that remains the best voice acting coaching I've ever gotten is just like, hey, learn to talk.
Oh, that's funny. I wanted to say that you picked up literature in the Army, which that's a first. I've not heard that before. And most people pick up smoking. Or dipping, or in the Army. That's what people usually pick up. Yeah. And the second thing I was gonna say, this is not about voice acting. How long have you been doing that?
Full time, 5 years.
Wow. So
but I was doing it. I was building my client base for some years before that. But yeah, 5 years. In last September, it was 5 years. So a little over 5 years.
It's cool. It's good stuff, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned growing up in a Christian private school, it sounded like.
Yeah.
And kind of being exposed to the classics. What are some classics that you like And then what is like a, you just think is an absolutely overrated writer? Mark Twain thought Jane Austen was terrible.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. That's funny.
He hated her writing. Hated it.
Oh, man. Wow. So it's hard to say like what my favorite writer is. I have a hard time with that. I know my favorite works there. Mark Twain though is up there. Mark Twain's incredible. Like I like Mark Twain because of his use of humor. Like what we talked, I don't know if we talked about on air or off air, but we're talking about how important humor is in communicating what you want. So I really enjoy Mark Twain. I really like some work I like. I love Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. That's a great poem. I learned this poem when I was in I just realized something's right here.
Sorry, not to interrupt. Okay, so this is Mr. R.H. Brown. He is from originally one of the Gullah Islands in South Carolina.
Oh, cool.
He ended up in Columbus, Mississippi, and was a reporter for the local CBS station. And so I grew up hearing Mr. Brown
His
mellifluous baritone read the news in the evening. And that was the first time. His was the first voice that I ever remember being moved by a human voice.
Oh,
Mr.
Wow.
Brown was the first time I remember that happening. And so Mr. Brown, if you're still in here, you're what an honor, sir. A real and an Army vet as well. That's really cool. But sorry to
it's all good.
You're saying you mentioned Ozymandias.
Yeah, I love Ozymandias. And when I was in school, one of the poems I learned was it's up there. It's one of my favorite poems, and it's called "I Have a Rendezvous with Death." And the name of the author escapes me.
Alan Seeger, maybe?
Seeger, yeah, that's right. Alan Seeger, yeah, thank you. And I learned the poem, and I thought it was a good poem back then. But I didn't know anything about Alan Seeger. And then I was well into adulthood before I realized that this was a World War I poet. And I love World War I poetry. World War I poetry is fantastic. And I just remember the day it hit me that the last stanza of "I Have a Rendezvous with Death" is the beginning of it is "I have a rendezvous with death at midnight in some flaming town." Now, when I learned that as a kid, I assumed it was like some metaphor of the end of your life. It was like, oh no, he actually meant "I have a rendezvous with death in some flaming town." That was pretty chilling. And then there's another one. Man, I'm blanking on the authors. You see why I don't think the author, it's a George something, but he wrote
I said you got to read more often.
I know, I agree with that. I can't remember his last name, but the poem "Dulce et Decorum Est."
Wilfred Owen.
Wilfred Owen. Okay, thank you. And that's another excellent one. And just thinking about the people who went to World War One, and first of what you know. And an unnecessary waste of millions of lives World War I was. I mean, just like an indefensible war, as far as war is usually indefensible, this one is obviously so, especially to the damage that it caused. But knowing that you're probably not gonna make it out of this, like knowing you're getting up, you're gonna go into combat, and you people are being mowed down left and right all around you, and how the words just sink into those pages and how powerful they are. It's one thing we're talking about the military again. Whenever this generation, this past like 20 years, you know, went into combat, look, yeah, it's combat always, and there's always dangers associated with it. But what I always said is, like, first off, like the power and the strength of our military versus who we're going against is comically different, as in the strength levels. And second, what's really on the line? And I think about like World War II, for example. Like, there was a good chance Hitler could have won that war, like a really good chance. Yeah. And you knew that. So not only did you have the looming threat of death, which is there in every war, but the looming threat, oh man, if we don't pull this off, the world is going to collapse. And so, yeah, poetry from wartime has always jumped out at me as some of the best.
Interesting. The I think to your point, I really like World War One poetry as well, and not that I have the exact same experiences, thankfully, but right. because of and especially some of the more, I wouldn't even say cynical, but more realistic, where it's like, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. What are we doing here? You know, we're just, these guys are just sending us into this meat grinder. To me, I sort of, when I look at our own, the way that the United States wages war, there's some real similarities, you know, like, oh, let's go, you know, mess with those people and, you know, whatever. I'm the same way. Yeah. With the war poetry. That's interesting. So I always like some of your hot takes on you know, how you will chop up a sacred cow into steaks and throw it on the grill. But what's an author that, like, a classic author that, like, yeah, I just don't like them. I think they're overrated, whatever.
Oh man, I'd have to think about that. Like, someone who I really don't like, and man, I don't know. I hate that I don't have it ready for you, but if it
comes up and you think, oh, you know, whatever, just tell us, because I know there's some.
I know there's some out there. I was like, I just don't get it. I don't understand. But I'm blanking right now, unfortunately.
Okay, you mentioned Sun Tzu the other day. talk about. I was so offended by what you said.
Really?
I'm just kidding.
Oh, okay.
I disagree with your take, and yet I was entertained. I would love to hear it again, maybe unpack it.
Yeah, sure. So what Jake is referring to is I did a video on TikTok talking about The Art of War. And all my life, I always heard people say, you know, there's certain books that you have to read. And one of them was The Art of War. And people would, you know, incessantly talk about how The Art of War has these deep insights into the human psyche and philosophy and how to, you know, structure yourself for success in personally and financially. And I was like, okay, all right. And so I remember getting a copy of the book in high school, late high school, I think. And it's a small, it's a pamphlet, more by basic. It's not really a book, it's a stretch. But maybe what, 80, 100 pages? I don't know. It was tiny. And I remember going through this thing. And for those of you who haven't read it, essentially The Art of War says stuff like, hey, your soldiers need to eat. Make sure you feed them. They need food and water, your horses as well. Make sure your supply lines are good. Try to steal food from your enemy so you don't use your own resources. Try to keep the high ground. Just like, just insultingly obvious stuff. And I'm looking at this and I was like, really? This is the stuff that people are, know your enemy. It's like, think before you make your plans. And then it made more sense when I actually read like what The Art of War was for. It was written like in the 5th century BC. And it was essentially a guidebook for the Chinese aristocracy. So back in these days, their military wasn't set up like ours now, where you actually have to work your way up to become a commander. No, you were born a prince, which meant when war broke out, you're a general now. And our army actually operated very similarly until super recently, like until like probably World War I is when this started to change. Like you look at the Civil War, Mexican-American War, stuff like that, people were just mayors, and when a war broke out, and they were colonels. Like, they didn't serve a day in the military at all. Like Thomas Jefferson was a colonel in the Revolutionary War. Dude, thankfully, he was a desk colonel. He never went to the field or anything like that. But that's just how this was. And so, you know, it's, you know, 450 BC, and the king tells you, hey, you need to gather up your peasants and send them to war, and you don't know anything about combat. The Art of War is pretty useful to you. Like, it actually tells you, you know, what to expect when you're a pampered, you know, Chinese aristocrat. And come at me, Sun Tzu. Come at me. You've been dead 2,500 years. I don't care what you have to say. But it's like, okay, I get why this book was influential at the time. But for me, for my personal life, like, use fire to destroy my enemies is not something I'm really interested in reading on how to make my life better. Well, so what were your thoughts? Like, did you really enjoy the book? And I imagine.
To your point, I think that's an excellent point, that it was written for the, not for possibly true soldiers, but for you know, rich kids that are about to go off to war.
Yeah.
And they don't know anything about even, you know, I mean, he probably could have written a book about how to build a fire. It was very like an army manual. And this is going to be, you know, a little bit on the gross side, but in there is in the Army FM, in the section under hygiene, it tells you which direction to wipe your behind. Did you know that?
I don't remember that.
That kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying? And that's kind of like, you know, I don't think I need the government telling me which way I need to clean myself. And yet there it is. But I think, you know, in a way, and I've never thought about it like that, Sun Tzu is written for, you know, the upper class who doesn't really know a lot of about the world around them and needs some real basic
stuff. It's basic training for military commanders. That's what it is. Yeah. Which you shouldn't have basic training, then become a commander. But hey, that's what they had, the system they had, you know.
Right. That's a very interesting thought. In my case, I like it because I think sometimes I'll get caught up in the weeds of something like the little details, which I know details are so important, but also sometimes you need to take a big picture view of things, of your problem, of your situation, of your leadership challenge, maybe of your opponent, whatever that might be. If it's in, you know, in my case, in business, it might be a coworker. It might be you know, another supervisor in another part of the factory, that kind of thing. And anyway, I have used it in business before, as far as in non-lethal situations, to good end. One of them was, we had a person at this one company I worked at that was a lying, stealing, cheat. They were just a terrible person who kind of had the management bamboozled that they were a good person that was doing their job and not trying to basically pull a Macbeth and go behind their back. And you know what I mean? They were just an awful person. And so with Sun Tzu, I actually talked to one of my coworkers and gave him a copy of Sun Tzu. I was like, okay. And he was not a military guy. And he was like, we're going to use some of these principles to get this individual exposed. And then management, when management sees it, they can deal with it how they wish, but that's probably going to be, they won't be working here anymore. And so we started implementing these, you know, little maxims out of Sun Tzu, and eventually the person was fired for cause. It wasn't like I was being awful. I was just like Jesus told the Pharisees, and it really ticked them off. Now you have no cloak for your sin. Like I drew the cloak back. Look at there. And they got fired.
I like that story because basically you had someone who was using Sun Tzu, you, on an opponent who was apparently following the works of Machiavelli. Like you had the prince versus the art of war is basically what you had going on.
That's what it was. That's exactly what it was.
You sound really clear now.
I didn't realize my mic this whole time has been like further away than it should have been.
Oh, so man. I'm learning so much about like the technology and stuff here with the mic and everything. Like I've done like recordings and I go back and listen to it and I realize my mic was unplugged the whole time. I was like, oh man, I did a great show with my first podcast I ever recorded was with a TikTok creator named Coach D Speaks. Okay. And I went back and listened to it. And his audio is clear as crystal. And mine sounds like I have like 5 marshmallows in my mouth. It is horrible. And it's heartbroken. But a couple of things I wanted to, if you don't mind, bring up by what you mentioned.
Yeah.
You talked about the Army field manual talking about how to wipe yourself, which I don't remember. Then again, the field manual is included in books I didn't read all the way through. Yeah. I'm not doing that. Like there's sections that I had to know, but I didn't bother reading at all. But my favorite one, well, not my favorite, but one that the Army, listen, for all the flaws of the United States Army, a lot of its organizational structure and you know, evaluations makes a lot of sense. Like I it really does. Like the way your evaluations from your raider and your senior raider and stuff, and right. Like your counselings, it's great. It's a great system. I mean, I throwing all the credit to the Army possible, but some of the field manual stuff and the regulations are absurd, but some are really good. And I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday about this, that the Civil War, I think something like 600,000 soldiers died in the Civil War. And the majority of them died from dysentery. They didn't die in combat. And that's because, you know, people were relieving themselves upstream and drinking the water downstream. And people didn't know that, you know, that would make you sick. And the whole field manual in the army set up telling you where to put the latrines, you know, how to make sure to keep everything clean. But it's weird that people didn't understand about, you know, how dirty water or unclean water could kill you until like the early night. It was like 1904. It was incredibly recent. And before that, people thought it was the smell that made you sick, which is why, like, the plague doctors, for those of you guys that know, had those weird beaks. They would have the beaks stuffed with potpourri so that they would keep the smell at bay. And because they thought the smell, and it sounds stupid to us, but you think about it, if you smell something gross, you throw up. And so that's probably why they thought that. And you mentioned a quote by Jesus, something about Jesus and the Pharisees. Another work that I like is the King James Bible. I think the King James, the prose of the King James Bible is 10 out of 10. It's fantastic. I agree. And I'm no longer a practicing Christian or even believe in God anymore, but I do love, like, memorizing a Bible passage doesn't feel, well, I don't care if it feels right, it doesn't sound as good from any, like, modern version than it does in, like, the King James. And older versions sound worse, too, so it was perfect. And also, I finally thought of this. This isn't, like, this writer himself isn't something that someone I don't like, but a work that everyone loves that I don't. If by Rudyard Kipling. I don't like that poem. Everybody does. And it's always up there with, like, you know, the best poems in literature. And it's one that doesn't ring with me. Like, I don't like how it sounds at all. It just doesn't work. So it took a while, but I got around to it.
Okay. So you don't like it. Is it because of the setup and the pattern of it, or is it the actual message? Or
message is fun. The message is great. It's the meter, and you know, how it's written is just, I just don't like how it flows. It's kind of like the Star Spangled Banner is. I don't like the Star Spangled Banner either. As far as it is, like, musically, it's one of the worst songs I've ever heard. Like, It barely rhymes. It's all choppy and truncated. No one would ever listen to that song for fun. I'll put it that way. No one would listen to that song. Like, if it weren't the national anthem, you wouldn't like it either. And and honestly, like, if you stop 10 random Americans on the road and ask them to not sing, but just quote the Star Spangled Banner, how many could get it right? Like, if it's more than four, I'd be shocked. They would mess something up along the way. And then when you're singing it, you have that Land of the Free, that really high note, and it's hard. It's like, man, let's get it. I would be willing to, like, there's so many other good patriotic songs, like America the Beautiful or God Bless America. Like, there's 1,000 better ones than that one, but that's another example of, I mean, it's not like a poetry people love, because I don't think they do, but they have a lot of importance to it. But how a poem flows means a lot. That's fantastic. That is fantastic. I love this so much, man. I love it so much.
I agree with that. I think the tune is very, that's a tough tune. I know it's an old British, like, melody that they sang back in the day. It was some popular, you know, it was like a pop song back in the 1750s or something. But yes, I think it's very, I don't know. It's not very musical.
It's hard on the ears. It is. Yeah. And there's so many other good national anthems out there. Sorry, I dropped my pen. I also found this out when doing these things is I have to write down thoughts that I have because I won't remember them. And Whitney Houston did on it. Yeah. Yeah. It's there's so few examples of great sounding national anthems. There's Whitney Houston and then there's Jimi Hendrix, like, playing it on the guitar. Those are the only ones that stand up at all. But O Canada is a great national anthem. It's just fantastic. Right. And so there's good ones out there. We don't have to, you know, settle for it. We're the United States, man. We can do better than this. Right. I draw my pen for a second.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the British do really well. Like, what is it? Britannia or whatever. That's a really, I like the pacing of that. O Canada is another one.
God Save the Queen, of course, is great. And they have, I don't know. They just have catchy songs too. Like, man, we're letting Great Britain beat us, folks. Come on. We can do better in music. I mean, this is, we got them.
Yeah. So the and I agree with I agree with this comment. I really enjoyed Chris Stapleton's kind of a different, he just took it a different way at the Super Bowl last year. I enjoyed that one.
I don't remember that one. Yeah.
It was real. I mean, it's, he's a country artist, but he's got this real haunting quality to his voice. And yeah, I mean, it's before the Super Bowl. It's on, it's on like YouTube. And that was a rare time that I remember seeing people like of all demographics sort of TikToking it and being like, this is amazing. Yeah.
So. You know, oh, sorry, but you know, that actually reminds me, because people, I hate that the song is so hard to sing in 100 different ways, even though everyone's familiar with it, is that whenever you have like a pop artist or, you know, come on, or a musician come on to sing the national anthem, inevitably someone's going to mess it up because it's so easy to mess up. And when people do, they just dogpile on them. Like, oh, can you believe they forgot? Yes, I can believe they forgot the lyrics to a song they never sing. That's, you know, hard to sing in the first place, you know, and in front of millions of people. Yeah, for the Super Bowl. Yeah, they're going to mess it up. And that bugs me because that happens all the time. So it's, I don't know why people ever sign up to do this, because the odds are that you're going to pull a Whitney Houston is pretty low. And most likely no one's going to remember it at all. But, you know, if you mess it up, they won't forgive you for the rest of your life. And that's pretty annoying.
Right. It's like, you know, beating a crippled kid in a wrestling match. It's kind of like,
yeah, exactly.
You might, you know, you're not going to win. You've got nothing to gain. Everything.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I think that a reason for that is people think, well, it's the national anthem. Of course I know it. I don't need the lyrics in front of me. And then you get out there, and then everybody's looking at you and listening, and then you start, your brain works differently, as I have found. When, you know, it's the things that are normally simple, all of a sudden, no, they ain't simple anymore. Man, if I'm public speaking or something, I mean, my script is like, here's your name, Jake Phillips. All right. There's all right. So, all right. We've covered some good ground, talked about overrated classics, Sun Tzu being one. If by Rudyard Kipling absolutely sucks, according to
it's not enjoyable. I don't enjoy If. I don't at all. It's another poem I had to memorize, and I hated it. I hated every time. In fact, it's one of the few I could not recite, not because it's long, but because I didn't like it, and so it just, like, my brain pushed it out as quickly as I could. I wanted to get to this real quick for you.
Yeah.
About the national anthem and how people like, what kind of an American are you for messing up the national anthem? It reminded me of a story of someone else I knew in the military. She was a lieutenant, and she was picked for, you know, one of those, you know, when they unroll the 50-yard long American flag at football games and stuff. And so she was one of the people that did that. And I remember her telling me that it's huge and you have, like, you know, 80 people carrying this thing. And she just remembers the entire time she was so nervous that she was going to drop this thing and, like, you know, have the flag hit the ground and everything and people would see it. And then I thought about the absurdity of this. It's like, you are wearing a military uniform. You raised your right arm and said that you were willing to die in defense of this country. But if you drop this giant cloth, people are going to say you're a bad American. Like, it's so strange, like, how much power we put into the pageantry and stagecraft of a patriotism that, like, we distract ourselves from what is and, you know, focus on what's represented. It's pretty crazy. And we do it all the time.
And to be technical, though, a 50-yard flag is not a real flag, right? So the customs and courtesies, it is a, you know, two-sided flag, it's whatever. A flag that they draw out onto the field is not an actual flag because it only has one side to it. and if you look, when they're done, they drop it on the ground and push it up against the stands. And so it's like, well, you know, let's go easy on them, because even if you are that kind of person, like, you dropped it, you're a bad person, it's not a real flag, and it's going to be laying in front of the stands in a wrinkled pile. You're not supposed to let the flag touch the ground. Absolutely. That's the flag customs and courtesies, but it's not a flag. It's not an actual flag. You know what I mean? It's a one-sided piece of cloth, and it's going to be piled onto the ground before the game and after the show as well.
And let's, here's all right. Here's my, I mean, me going to hot take land again is like, also, who cares if a flag actually does touch the ground? Who cares? Like, let's be real here. Like, it's like, I remember when I was in fifth grade, this is one of my earliest, like, agent provocateur moments. I remember in fifth grade, we were learning about flag customs and courtesies. And so they were saying, you know, you hang a flag, you know, if the weather is bad, you take it down. When the flag is tattered, you burn it, you know, you give it an honorable burial and stuff. And so I remember asking, you know, 10-year-old TJ, I'm sitting there, I was like, okay, wait a minute. This is just a cloth though, right? And my teacher's like, well, it's not just a cloth, it's a flag. And I was like, but if we dyed it a different color, then it wouldn't be the flag anymore. Like, it's not like the red, white, and blue isn't an intrinsic property of this object. Like, we just painted, we just dyed these colors, and now I got to treat it better. That doesn't make sense to me. And then about why the flag doesn't touch the ground, like, there's a reason that rule existed, because before the age of radios and communications, five, you're selling me short, but radios and communication, the flag and the bugle was basically your command and control. Like, that's how you moved units. So if your flag touched the ground, you could have chaos. People would die. But guess what? That's not going to happen if you drop your flag on the ground. Like, there's no military maneuvers that are going to suffer because you drop your flag. So, I mean, the obsession with keeping this rule from 150 years ago is like, no. And the Army does this all the time. So I see why, like, they love their customs and courtesies. Like, you know how you don't stand in front of your formation and how that was a really big deal? Like, you insulted them. That was always odd to me. Now, I don't know if this is the case, but it makes sense to me that let's say you're Baron von Steuben or whatever, or I'm sorry, Lafayette and everything back in the day. And you're teaching the Americans how to, you know, form an effective military. How did they fight? They fought in those formations. If you stepped in front of those formations, you could get shot. So not standing in front of formation makes sense in 1789. Today, who cares? Like, it's just this thing that we've continued on throughout the years. And we do this a lot with a lot of different ways. But the flag one has always stuck out to me because people, like, really get charged up about it. It's like, there's really no need to.
That what you said about the signaling is very interesting, because that's, you know, like you said, they used to, before radios, they used, you know, their command and control, their ability to move troops around in a chaotic environment was through sounds and sights, not, you know, not radio waves. And so bugles were big, flags were big. I really like history. And one thing that I like about history is the history of the American West. I think it's fascinating. It's terribly sad. Like, there's so many things about it, but there was one battle out west, and I forget exactly where it was, but in a Lakota warrior had gotten a bugle off of the battlefield and learned to play it.
What? Oh, so there I didn't was, know that. That's cool.
Right. So there was this one battle. So where the cavalry's like, okay, charge. And, you know, there's smoke and, you know, people yelling and it's chaotic. And so they all start charging. Well, then there's immediately the sound of retreat. And so all the guys like back up the hill, like,
amazing.
What are we doing? And this happened multiple times until they realized, wait a second, there's somebody over there that knows.
That's so cool, man. You know, that's so cool.
Anyway, that's, to me, that's hilarious. He probably was saving lives on both sides.
Right. That's so great. When I was in college, I went to a Christian college too, by the way. Like, my indoctrination was strong, like, all the way through. I went to a Christian Bible college, and I had my history instructor. He had us watch this video series called How the West Was Lost. I love a good play on words too. So I was already in. Like, I didn't know what it was about, but I was like, oh, I love a play on words. But it was basically telling the story of the Old West from the American Indian standpoint, which you don't get a lot of. And right. So the entire thing was just, you know, their histories and their descendants and their stories. And it was devastating, obviously. Like, it was like a real punch in the gut to watch. And it did help me. I've always loved history, too. But it did help me to stop looking at history in the, you know, Eurocentric, ethnocentric way that we do tend to look at history and say, oh, yeah, there's other people in the world besides the United States. And, you know, they had their opinions of what was going on as well. And this hit me in my unit. In my unit, we had our unit crest was it was like a bushel of wheat or something. And it had audacia across it, which is Latin for by daring deeds. And it had 12 arrows like on the sides. And it's because our unit was, it was the only unit in the army that has a naval banner on their colors, because our unit fought in the Barbary Wars in the 1800s with the Navy and the Marines. And but anyway, the 12 arrows were there in commemoration of our unit's participation in the Indian Wars. And I was like, ooh, not a good look. I mean, it's like, is that something that we're going to be bragging about, you know? And like, it's right there. And so, yeah, it and the American and the Native American standpoint of history is like, it's severely lacking. People don't think much about it at all. Like, we think about, oh yeah, they're the ones who lost, but we don't actually think about, you know, their culture and outside of the spiritualism thing. Like, we know about, you know, peyote and the peace pipe and stuff like that, but actually through their historical lens is a great way to look at things.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite books, I know you'll never read it, but whoever might be watching it might read it, is it's called Sitting Bull, His Life and Legacy by Ernie LaPointe, his great grandson.
Oh, cool.
And so it has so much stuff in there about not only Sitting Bull, but the Lakota culture and the thought process behind different things they would do. You know, and it's, I've read a lot of books about the subject, but most of them are from, you know, this Cambridge professor that, you know, that kind of thing. And this is, it's like he's talking about dad or, you know, his own family. And it just gives it a real personal thing. Let's see. Thank you for coming. It was great having you. Thanks for your input. But he has agreed to come on this podcast in the future. I'm trying to still schedule it up, but that would be really cool to you know, have him on here and talk exactly about that kind of thing. Like, you know, what's some things that, you know, if you sort of go through school, you're not going to hear or whatever. So, man, it's been almost an hour. It's flown by. I've had a really good time.
Those are the best ones. Those are the best ones.
Well, man, I would love to, maybe have you read it could be something you like or don't like, but sort of narrate something for us and then tell us, you know, your thoughts on it real quick.
Well, I mean, I already brought it up. We should go with Ozymandias then, since I'll go with that one. So Ozymandias is a poem written by Percy Bysshe Shelley. He was one of the romantic poets. You'll like Lord Byron, John Keats, and he's also the husband of Mary Shelley, who you all will be familiar with as writing wrote Frankenstein, who's an incredibly fascinating character all on her own. But one of my favorite works in all of literature is Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. And I guess I'll recite it first. I'll go through it before I talk about it. But it goes, I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that the sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. And that poem gets me every time. Like I just reading it, just like it, I just feel it because the context of the poem is what makes it so good. Like if you don't like know anything about what he's talking about, it doesn't really hit home. But Ozymandias is the Greek name for Pharaoh Ramses II of Egypt, who is regarded as, you know, one of the greatest rulers in all of antiquity. He lived like 3,000 years ago and somehow lived to 90 years old, which is an incredible feat of itself for someone who lived that far back. He had you know, dozens of wives and over 100 kids, many of whom he outlived. That's how long this guy reigned. And he was responsible for some of the greatest, economic and cultural growth of I think it's the Middle Kingdom of ancient Egypt, but that's who they're talking about. And it starts off with a traveler telling, you know, our narrator that he saw this statue. Well, he saw the remnants of a statue, two vast and trunkless legs of stone. And on the pedestal, it says, my name is Ozymandias, the king of kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. And then he looks around, and the only thing around is a barren wasteland, nothing. So there's a double entendre to the statement unintentionally, in that when Ozymandias had this statue erected 3,000 years ago, when he wrote, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair, that statue would have been in the middle of a bustling metropolis, like in Memphis or something. And people would have seen, you know, temples and pyramids and oases and streams and markets and families and armies, like all built in honor of this great ruler. And he says, so look on my works in despair. But now when we look on it, there's nothing at all. It's like he never existed. And it's a testament to not only the precarity of power and of, our man-made structures, but also to the precarity of human life, that, you know, everything you do one day is going to be gone. And look, none of us are going to be remembered as long as Ramses II. So like, if he's going to be forgotten and his works are going to be erased, so is everybody else's. Now, that doesn't mean they don't matter, because, you know, obviously the people around you matter and that their thoughts and their opinions and their life experiences are important. But to not what I get from it, because, like, you know, literature is a subjective, like you can understand what you like, but that's clearly the message. And what I like to get from it is to, do my best that I can, but not to think too highly of myself or any one person, because, you know, we are just people after all. You know, despite what Ramses and other pharaohs thought, he was not a god. He was a man, just like the rest of us. And that's one of the many, many, many reasons that poem has stuck so well with me over all these years.
That's awesome. Well, thank you. That was great. Great analysis. I think that's a brilliant poem, but also
so good.
Like that's really that's some good analysis there. I like that. And if you follow TJ on social media, let me get that banner back up with your whoops.
Speaking of power,
let's see. How did I do that earlier? I had it right. not this one. Oh, I think I hide it.
Hey, there we go.
Okay. Nice. So, you definitely ought to check out TJ on, and he's got some scalding hot takes on a wide range of topics. And I need to have you back. We'll talk more.
I'd really love to.
Enjoyed this. And listen, you're a great conversationalist, right?
Same. Right. Actually. I say anytime someone wants to put a microphone in front of me, I will talk. It's like, it's the one thing in life I'm good at. So I would absolutely love to. And, I mean, you guys already familiar with Jake. I'm so used to being on the other side, telling people, hey, you know, this person's really good. They already know about you. But it's like, I really enjoy your work. I love listening to it. It's such a simple concept of, the even the name, the Culture Bumpkin. I just love it. And reading stuff in your accent, you know, your native accent is something I've never heard before. And so, and your selection is fantastic. I'm so glad that I ran across your content.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that so much. And if you're watching this live or catching the replay, make sure you go follow TJ definitely on TikTok. Do you have any other handles, any other places that you
can... No, Power's Taken Not Given is where you can find me, TikTok and on YouTube. It's it's the literature over there. If you're a literature lover, it's sprinkled in. Like, it comes in every once in a while where I do literature. It's mostly politics, occasionally jokes and history lessons, and the literature gets sprinkled in when it can. But I try my best.
Good deal. Good deal. Well, TJ, thank you very much.
And, thanks so much.
And I'll click off. I want to mention something after we go offline about your YouTube to link it up and everything. But thank you very much for watching, and we will talk at you later.
You've been listening to The Cultured Bumpkin, a literature podcast with Jake Phillips. Thank you very much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you enjoyed this, would you mind going and subscribing and leaving a nice review on whatever podcast platform you heard this on? I would really appreciate it. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.